Any news that's worth knowing, with attitude that's worth showing. Get ready to listen, let's go. The show is called Maria. Welcome to Maria. For honesty and to the point news. Opinion straightforward, you can't lose. Get ready, subscribe, let's go. Welcome to Maria. You know you're gonna hear a lot from guests with credentials that say, I won't let America go astray. The show is called Maria. Get to know Maria. Listen to her truth and views. You're bound to love Maria.
Okay, my guest today is the author of what I'm going to say is the absolute best book of its type I have ever read, and that's saying a lot. His name is Dr. Will Tuttle, and the book is called The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. He is an educator, he's a composer, a pianist, a writer. He's been an animal rights and peace activist for over 20 years, vegan for 27 years. He's also co-founded the Prayer Circles for Animals and Circle of Compassion Ministry. So I'm very, very happy to have Will Tuttle with me today. Hello, Will.
Hello, Maria. I'm really glad to be here with you.
Well, I have to tell you, you know, reading your book, I can tell you chances are 95% of the people you quote in this book have been on my show. So when I got your book, I said, well, there can't be anything new in here. And then I started reading it, and I was like, yay, this is the best book I've ever read on the both subjects, whether it's, you know, animal rights or being a vegan. And I think I've waited a long time for somebody to write a book for the actual reason that I myself personally went vegan, which had nothing to do with my physical health, but everything to do with my spiritual health.
Well, that's really the foundation, actually, for me as well. When I first actually started to go vegan myself, actually, I was vegetarian. It was really for the spiritual reasons too. And I think that if we go into this more deeply, we begin to see that it has enormous repercussions, not only for us spiritually, but also for us socially and psychologically, and as well as environmentally, and, you know, the other ways, you know, physical health and so forth. But really, when you look more deeply into the ramifications of the mentality of violence and cruelty that's required for us to eat the kind of foods that we just routinely eat in this culture, we see, I think, what I call this driving hidden fury behind all of the problems that we just don't seem to be able to begin to address effectively. And I think it's really traceable to the violence on our plates.
Mm-hmm. Well, to say that it's a diet that can actually create world peace, I'm sure to a lot of people that's quite a stretch.
Well, it is, because most people are eating animal foods, and so and actually for me it would have been a stretch also. But I think once we begin to see the what is, you know, the mentality that's required, the set of attitudes that's required for us to eat the flesh and secretions of routinely brutalized animals three times a day or two times a day, the way it's done in this culture on such epic proportions, we see that it requires a mentality of disconnectedness, of denial, of oppression and exclusion, of elitism and privilege, as well as of violence and exploitation. And really, I think underlying all of that is a mentality of reduction, of reducing beings to things. And the ancient spiritual teachings all agree on a few basic things. One is whatever we put out comes back. You know, what goes around comes around. Mm-hmm. And another is that whatever we would most want for ourselves, we're called to give to others. And another is that whatever we most forcefully ignore will control us the most. Mm-hmm. And what we do to animals is so extremely brutal that we basically, you know, just don't want to think about it, and so we ignore it. We forcefully ignore it as a culture, and so we have this kind of like this as the proverbial elephant in the living room that everyone studiously ignores, and that is the violence towards animals for food and the routine reduction of them. And the other ancient teaching is that what we due to others actually comes back and affects us so directly. So we end up reducing ourselves and creating a whole economic system where we reduce ourselves, and we find ourselves reduced, really, I think, in this capitalist system to mere units,
right.
And just like we do to animals.
Well, you know, two other sayings come to my mind. One is, you reap what you sow.
Right.
The other is, you are what you eat.
Right.
And if ever there was a book that specifically tells you exactly what you are because of exactly what you're eating, this is the book. And, you know, years ago, I think it was Isaac Singer that said there was no such thing as a meat-eating environmentalist. And in the spiritual community, especially in the metaphysical spiritual community, a lot of metaphysicians, and, you know, myself for a while did the same thing, came up with a million excuses for eating animals. But I really believe that you can't truly be a spiritual person and be a meat eater. And your book gives you, I couldn't have written the book better than what you wrote.
Yeah. Well, thanks. You know, I think the metaphysical community, the way it stands today, I think in the West, it has a huge blind spot, and I think really a fundamental ceiling on our potential for spiritual growth. All the great spiritual teachers of all the traditions have said that really there's two sides to the spiritual path. One is raising consciousness, you know, through practices, through meditation and so forth, and spiritual disciplines. The other is to purify our behavior. And people have this idea that, well, if we just kind of work on our consciousness, that somehow the behavior will change and we'll become better people, more kind, more just, more, you know, concerned and compassionate and so forth. And that we don't really have to do anything about that, especially when it comes to the treatment of animals.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we really need to understand now in this culture is that behavior is also determines consciousness. You know, just as consciousness determines behavior, the opposite is also true. So my consciousness will never be able to go higher than the level of my behavior, especially something like eating food, which is routine, practiced behavior that has huge ethical ramifications, because it's not just eating the animals, it's taking out my wallet and paying people to electroshock them, castrate them, mutilate them, confine them brutally, and then kill them. So I'm really basically paying my brothers and sisters to do terrible things that brings out the worst in them, and then the environmental ramifications, whereas all the grain that could be fed to starving people is fed to these animals, so that those who are privileged and rich in the West can eat cheap chicken and fish and dairy products and beef and pork and so forth.
Right.
People are starving.
Right.
So it has huge ramifications. It's not like just telling, talking about what we're eating. It's actually what we're practicing. We're practicing disconnecting, and we're practicing causing violence.
Well, you know, you have a comparison in the book where you say that it's as though we're hiring assassins to assassinate our food, but we're still just as guilty as the assassin as if we hired them to kill a person for us. I mean, there's a lot of pretty strong stuff in there. Now, let me start with this, Will.
Okay.
For whatever reason, and I'm sure some of my listeners are squirming in their seat, and I know I'm going to hear some shit about this show from them. I always do. When I do a vegetarian show, it seems that it bothers people more than if I do an animal rights show or anything else. And when I go out with my friends who are meat eaters, it really seems to bother them and make them very uncomfortable that I'm a vegetarian. Why do you think that is? Why do people get so upset even talking about this subject?
I think, Maria, that people get upset for one basic reason, and that is that we humans have an extreme aversion to eating the flesh and secretions of brutalized animals. I mean, it's disgusting to us at a very deep level, and we'd go to great lengths to disguise it by cooking it, by covering it with in buns and burger and with lettuce and tomato and onions and all kinds of sauces and all kinds of euphemisms that we use, chicken nuggets or whatever. So it's not only very fundamentally disgusting to us at a deep level to eat the flesh of animals, and if you look at our physiology, you'll see why. We don't have any of the equipment that naturally carnivorous animals have. We don't salivate when we see a cow going,
Right.
So
we don't go over to them and try to bite them with our little teeth and start eating them.
I'm sorry?
We don't go over to them and start biting them with our teeth.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's the last thing we would ever want, think of doing. So, but the other thing is that we're forced into this by all of the institutions in our culture as little children. No one ever freely chose to say, go under a cow and try to suck on her teeth and get some milk or eat the flesh of an animal. No one chose that. We're forced into it as children by all the institutions of our culture, including our family, our education, our doctors and teachers, and the government. Every institution is basically lined up to promote this at the deepest of all possible levels. I believe it's the core of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
So we all feel a deep, and I think actually healthy, sense of guilt about this, a very excruciating sense of grief about it. And that's why it's just a taboo subject. I think it's the most taboo subject to talk about, and so I really applaud you, actually, for having the courage to bring this up directly, because in our culture, when we're killing no one knows exactly, but around 25 million land animals and probably around another 50 million water animals every day just in the United States,
mm-hmm.
that takes huge armies of people doing massive amounts of brutality against animals. And it takes so much psychological energy to perform that work. So it takes, I think, just as much to cover it all up so we don't have to think about it and keep it hidden. And so you, just by being a vegetarian or being a vegan and not eating it, you're triggering this guilt and this...
I'm telling you, I don't think it would bother
right.
people more if I took, a needle of heroin and stuck it in my arm. I'd probably get some compassion. But it's an amazing thing to me, I'll walk into a restaurant and some of my friends with me, will say, do you guys have a smoking section? Oh, no. And I'll be the one very loudly to say, do you have a non-meat eaters section? Because the smell and sight of people eating dead animals sickens me. And, I'm a very loud person, so nobody misses it. I usually don't get an answer. But it's kind of funny because I make a point of doing that even if I walk into Denny's. Oh, well, you can't smoke in this restaurant. And I'll pick up their plastic-coated menu, and I'll say, excuse me, but it's okay to eat this milkshake, this hamburger, and I'll start giving them facts and figures on heart disease, kidney disease, et cetera, et cetera. And no one ever answers me, Will. I just get the deer in the headlights look from them.
You're totally right. I mean, it's amazing if you that you're doing that. But I do think that will be coming at some point. I mean, people... When we start to just get the understanding out there more, people will feel this sort of sense of shame.
Right.
What
and
they're
you know,
doing
like,
if eating animal.
Right.
I mean, it's so unnecessary for one thing, and it causes such horrible cruelty and violence and death and destruction to
right.
generations and animals and people.
And for years, when I tried to make excuses for myself, even though I was teaching, metaphysics, teaching the medicine wheel, working for the environment, the turning point for me was John Robbins' book. I think it was called The Food Revolution. I was reading it on a plane on my way to Tahiti, and it just finally clicked.
Right.
And I said, that's it. I'm done. And I think everybody, has that eureka moment, and hopefully this show might be a eureka moment for a few people out there. Now,
right.
The main thing about your book, and I will tell you that I have never written an author as many times as I have written you, almost on completion of each chapter I was writing to
right.
you. You probably thought I was a crazy woman. But when I got to the third chapter, I was like, oh my God. I says, I'd like to read this entire book on the air. And that never happens to me, trust me. But the connections you make are so easy to see. We look at how much disease is out there. So many of my friends with cancer, heart disease, their arteries clogged, they can't breathe, they have nervous diseases, they're stressed out to the max, and they don't make the connection that that's what they're eating.
Right.
If they really knew the fear and the horror and the torture and the rape and the killing of these animals,
right,
they might be able to make that connection.
Right. It's all kept covered up, though, actually. And
well, yeah, it's cognitive dissonance at its best, is the
right,
way I see it.
It is. It really is. And, you know, we say, well, we're just, you know, we're good, kind, loving, courageous and just people. We just like to have some pork chops and lobster now and then and steak and chicken nuggets. And so that's right there is where the shadow just gets huge, and we have this huge, you know, unfaced dimension of not only our personal life but our public life that everyone agrees we won't talk about, and it creates this huge shadow which will then numbs us to actually what we're doing. It reduces our actual intelligence to be able to understand at a deeper level what we're doing on this planet and how we can solve our problems effectively. And then not only that, we end up projecting the shadow, which means we see the unfaced part of ourselves, our own violence and brutality, and basically that we're terrorists to these animals. And we then see these enemies that we create, you know, billions of dollars worth of toxic, deadly weapons to attack them. And actually, I think a lot of it is a projection of our own violence that we've internalized, that we keep acting out on each other in abusive ways.
Right. So if we terrorize animals, then, of course, we develop the fear of terrorists in two-legged animals.
Right.
And we don't make that connection.
Right.
Now, you had a sentence in the book, food is eaten and becomes us.
Yes.
Which is another way of saying we are what we eat. But I think a lot of people don't realize that you're also taking in a specific vibration and energy when you eat.
Well, that I think is something that's even more taboo to talk about. And I do have a whole chapter on that. And
we might get a lot of hate mail after today's show, or we might get people that love it. Who knows? But, you know, I can give you a good explanation, Will. My daughter and I have a real typical mother-daughter psychotic relationship, and part of it is the play fighting that goes on forever. 2 years into me being a vegetarian, my daughter said to me, "What happened to you, Ma? You're not fun to fight with anymore."
Oh, wow.
And when she said that, I realized that, I have some sort of inner peace, and I wonder if it's connected to my diet. Because
right.
She really can't rile me the way that she used to. Actually, very little can. And I think that that's a major part of what you get out of reading this book, is that the vibration you take in, if everything is energy, if you're eating the energy of, you know, fear and murder and the rest of it, of course, that energy has to affect your body. Do you agree?
Is this?
Go ahead.
The metaphysics. I have a chapter called "The Metaphysics of Food" in the book, and that goes into what I think is sort of the unspeakable dimension of this, which is that the animals that we eat are so stressed, and I mean they're literally driven insane. I think pigs will be just banging their heads against the bars of their stalls, you know, over and over again, and chickens are driven into insanity, and so they're in enormous physical and psychological pain and stress, and the energy of that, I think, is something that we have to take into account. And we're actually eating these vibrations in the dairy products and eggs and in the flesh of these animals. And people from all over the world have recognized for a long time that this has a powerful effect. And so I think we're very naive to think that we can just eat these foods and not be affected by them. And I think it shows how, in many ways, how numb we've become, that we don't even, you know, feel that, how disconnected we are from the vibrations of things. And also it shows how materialistic our culture is, that we think that if you can't measure something with a particular kind of instrumentation, that it doesn't exist. I think it shows how primitive we are, actually.
Right.
So that these vibrations exist, and they do affect us.
Absolutely. I mean, if, you know, indeed everybody's correct that everything is energy, you know, all life is energy, then
right.
What kind of energy are people taking in
right.
when they're eating that kind of energy?
Yeah, to feed that to themselves or to their loved ones, you know, it's, once you see it, it becomes very clear. The difficulty is that we're, again, forced into it from the time we're children. We lose our mother's breast, if we're ever, you know, lucky enough to get that, and the next thing we know, we're getting these little baby jars, baby food jars that have veal and chicken and turkey and beef and cheese and macaroni and so forth in there. And we absolutely just go right along with it. We don't have any reference point not to, and I think most people have such a difficult time facing the fact that they're eating horror and misery and causing that, and yet I think that's one of the driving forces behind the huge profits that pharmaceutical corporations are making. I just read the other day that the biggest selling drugs are drugs for depression. And what are we eating? We're eating massive depression, especially in dairy products. When cows are repeatedly raped and have their babies stolen and then raped again, have their babies stolen, think of what that would be like. You know, we're mammals like they are. We love our babies, you know, like they do. And to undergo that kind of brutality and have our babies stolen, and they used to know, the people always knew that if a mother was upset, that her milk would make her baby sick, so she shouldn't give it her, you know,
right,
her milk
of course,
to a baby.
Right. So it's
she nurse her baby when she's upset. Well, think that's what we're doing exactly with these dairy cows. We're eating all this energy of the milk of these cows that are grieving and depressed and panicked and in pain and suffering and, you know, being totally terribly treated. Even so-called organic dairies, they still can't move around. Their babies are still stolen from them. They wean on organic dairies. They wean the babies on blood. That's on organic dairies.
Mm.
So they is because there's so much more blood available than there is milk.
Ugh, triple ugh.
Yeah,
let
I
me.
Know.
Would it be okay with you if I read a chapter out of? I mean, a paragraph out of your book.
Go right ahead.
Okay, and this is on the metaphysics of food under the section you call Mask and Fear, so that people might be able to understand the way you make comparisons in this book, which I have to say is the best written thing I've read in forever. This unseen shadow of violence generates an irrepressible energy field within our culture. All animal researchers know that fear is one of the most powerful and basic emotions for all animals, including us. And extreme fear is an inescapable reality for the animals in our factory farms and slaughterhouses. Albert Schweitzer, in Urging Kindness to Animals, wrote, "Pain is a more terrible lord than even death himself. By inflicting massive amounts of both acute pain and chronic pain on the animals we eat, we generate similarly massive amounts of acute fear and chronic fear. We eat terror and thus are fascinated with it, lured by the lurid, the grotesque, and the violent. Our fascination with blood, death, terror, and violence is a manifestation of the repressed shadow of our wholesale brutality and killing of animals, sublimated and projected into countless expressions in the mass media and in popular entertainment. Violence and horror in movies, novels, and music fascinate and attract us only because we are regularly eating violence and horror and are therefore complicit." So eating animals, whether we visit the slaughterhouse or not, or cut their throats or not, still makes us complicit in the genocide that is happening on the other earthlings, right?
Exactly right, Maria. And you know how they say someone always returns to the scene of the crime. I think there's this attraction. When we do something violent and abusive, we just become fascinated with that. And we see this over and over again in people that is exactly what happens. And so I think because we're basically the causal agents of these knives and the deadbolt, the stunning, and all this torture of these animals, we find that in the mass media, this stuff is selling, you know, and I know it's not vegans that are attracted to this. I mean, it's...
Right. Well, maybe that's why so many Americans turn a blind eye or think that torturing prisoners is also okay.
Exactly. I think that's extremely important point to make, actually.
Mm-hmm. Now, for people listening at home, check out these websites, worldpeacediet.org, willtuttle.com, and circleofcompassion.org. And please don't argue with me until you've read this book. Once you read this book, I'd love to open up a debate. I'd love to do that. You talk about in your book at length, and I think that it's important because a lot of people really don't know how this all started. And you talk about the herding culture, and you quote Jim Mason, who I had on the show years ago. His book is also excellent. I think it's called The Unnatural Order.
Right.
Explain to my listeners what that means, a herding culture.
Sure. It's again, I won't be able to do more than just give a very quick summary, but basically, our culture, I believe, today is the same in its very core, which is that it It is organized around one thing primarily, and that is herding animals. And that's the fundamental organization of our culture. It's not obvious today like it was, a couple hundred years ago, or 150 years ago even, or even 100 years ago. It was obvious. It's always been obvious that our culture is basically a herding culture, that we eat animals for food, herded animals for food, at the end of the day, whatever work we're doing. Nowadays, the animals are kind of hidden away in these vast sheds and things that we call factory farms or confined animal feeding operations. But herding animals has only been going on about 8,000 to 10,000 years, which, seems like a long time, but it's not that long, I think, bigger picture. And around 8,000 to 10,000 years ago, people, ironically, in what is now the present country of Iraq, began to had this idea that they own animals, wild animals that up to them had been wild, and they were goats and then sheep and then later, a couple thousand years later, cattle. And these animals became the wealth of the people who owned them. They were the capital.
Right.
The Latin word capita means head, and so whoever owned the most cattle was the richest and had the most power, and you needed land and water for those. And so this ushered in a new era that had never been seen before on this planet, which was an era of war, the very first wars that continued on all the way up till the present time. But especially if you just trace the prehistory and up to the historic era, which emerged 3,000 years ago with the very first writings,
mm-hmm.
like the Epic of Gilgamesh in Sumeria and the Iliad and the Odyssey in the ancient Greek and the Old Testament writings, you say by that time very clearly that by then the culture had been established, and it was a society that was based on a wealthy elite, an aristocracy that had emerged that owned the capital. They owned the goats and sheep and cows. These animals were reduced, and when we reduced them, we reduced all of nature. We see nature more and more being seen as resources. We see the wild animals, these wonderful wild animals, being reduced to the status of being pests that we have to get rid of. We find women at the same time being reduced, because the whole science of this early time was the attempt by men to get more milk and more meat and more wool from animals, and so they were breeding them, and so what had always been seen as very sacred and holy, which is women giving birth to young and caring for them young and nursing the young and so forth, more and more began to be seen as something to be controlled, and women lost their power and it was stolen from them, and men reduced women. So by the time the historic period emerged, you find women are bought and sold like chattel property. We have the first slavery, the first time people started massively enslaving each other, because when they had the first wars, also these large-scale wars, because this was the way to get rich quick, was to was for some wealthy capitalist, someone who owned a lot of cattle. The first kings and so forth, they would go and have a war against others, another rich capitalist, and everybody who lost, if you lost, everyone who was a loser would be enslaved. The men would be castrated and become the slaves, and women would become concubines, who would become slaves also, and the animals would become the property of whoever won. So this whole era of emerged of a rich elite making a huge amounts of money on war that they sent everybody else into, and the violence in it, and the whole thing actually is only supportable, and it gets its energy from, I think, really the fact that everyone is eating these animals and sees these animals as mere objects to be used, and so the whole culture participates, and by participating in that back then and today, we contribute to it, we actually make it possible. And this culture required men to change, men to become harder and more brutal and capable of sustained violence against animals, and especially cows, cattle, are so big and powerful. So you have the very first word for war on this planet being the word gavya, the ancient Sanskrit word gavya, which literally means the desire for more cattle.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first word for war, and it spread, I think, from there around the Mediterranean to Europe to the United States, or to the so-called New World, and it's been and it's still spreading. Actually, you can see it still spreading through ConAgra and McDonald's and Heifer International and different institutions that spread this culture of violence against animals and war and domination of women and so forth.
Exactly. Well, you know, when you talk about how a lot of these cows, especially dairy cows, are repeatedly raped so that they can produce more, and you make the comparison to women being raped, when you talk about the steers that are castrated and you talk about our men eating that meat and so many men today who are sexually unable to perform, you know,
right.
I mean, you know, to me, it's such clear comparisons and so well done that I was just like almost ready to just scream it all off the rooftop. When you look at when they talk about George Bush, and I'm sure you'll see the menu of the White House will be printed for Thanksgiving, for Christmas. I always look and see how much animals this guy eats. And I think about Dennis Kucinich.
Right.
And why he's so cool and calm and out there for peace, for a Department of Peace, you know, doing his job, and make the comparison. And to me, it's like, well, yeah, look at what this guy eats. No wonder he wants to just continue killing people all around the world.
Right. It's a, that's the way it's always been. You know, the those who are in power at the top of this of the so-called hierarchy are the ones who eat the most flesh of brutalized animals. And I think they become the numbest and the most violent.
And the dumbest. And, let's not leave
it's
out.
No, it's no different today than it's always been. Mm-hmm. And I think if we... if we, though, who are not at the top of that pyramid, you know, if we're also eating the animals, we put ourselves above them, and we basically end up reaping the violence ourselves. And I think we'll find that this is a driving force, I believe, behind the loss of our freedom, the loss of our rights, the loss of our privacy, the loss of our media, being more and more controlled by the wealthy elite.
Yeah, because they look at us as cattle.
Change. Yeah.
They look at us as cattle, and everything they're doing now, from the RFIDs to the chips to the e-port passports, it's all about reining in the herd. We're the herd now.
Right. And so we will not this is getting really important. And I think seeing that whatever we do to animals, we end up doing to us. We end up doing to humans.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing that in the new farm bill, they are actually putting in there universal microchipping of all animals.
Right, where next?
That's the preliminary step
mm-hmm.
of doing the same thing to all humans. And I think we have to realize that if we really want to have our freedom, then we're called to free those that we're dominating. And
uh-huh.
if we don't, otherwise we'll just be we'll get what we're sowing. We're sowing seeds of violence, domination, oppression, and we end up experiencing oppression and being oppressed ourselves.
Right, and I remember the years ago a quote by Henry Kissinger when he was talking about our troops, and he said that they were dumb animals and that only dumb animals would go into the service. So you got to look at how do these elitists look at all of us, and is it the same thing we're guilty of, and if so, how do we change it? Will, we need to go to a short break. When we get back, I wanted to talk a little bit about a lot of different religious founders who actually started their system, including Unity Church, on vegetarian principles, and then that seemed to go away. So stay with us, especially if you're a member of Unity, because that'll interest you, and we'll be right back.
Thank you for opening your hearts and minds by subscribing to The Maria Show at www.maria.net. No fundraisers, no begging for money, just the good old honor system of recognizing the value of what is offered to you. It seems everyone has an agenda attached to truth. Maria has an agenda too. Waking discriminating minds up to break free from the grasp of the controllers of this world and stop them. Her library holds thousands of timeless interviews and real news as it happened, a living history. Be generous. Donate or subscribe today. Maria is generous in her indefatigable quest to bring the best information to the best listeners out there. Go to www.maria.net right now. Let your conscience decide what amount you can commit to each month to support the love, peace, and truth movement. MERIA.net. That's MERIA.net. Now, back to Maria.
Okay, I'm speaking with Dr. Will Tuttle, his book, The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. And of course, if your body gets healthier, well, that's just a nice little extra, but shouldn't be the reason you do it. Will, before the break, I talked about, and I was pretty surprised, it was something new for me to read that Unity Church and some other religions actually started out as vegetarians. What happened?
You know, I think basically the founders of religions typically, in their spiritual quest, uncover these truths, and they understand this at a deep level. That the only way to spiritual health and harmony and to higher consciousness is through kindness and compassion to all life, and not to exclude any living beings, any sentient beings, from the sphere of our compassion. But inevitably, the culture itself is so basically antithetical to this idea that in order for these the ideas to continue or the religion to continue, it gets covered up very quickly. And Unity Church, you're right, is a perfect example of this. And I've been spent the last, I think I'm in my 18th year full time of presenting at Unity Churches every single weekend. I give music, the message, Sunday morning talk, and do a workshop on developing intuition, do concerts. And so I know the Unity movement very well. I've been to hundreds and hundreds of churches all over the United States and even in other countries as well. It was founded by Charles and Myrtle Fillmore in the late 1800s. These people were ethical vegetarians. They were vegans, actually. They didn't eat any animal foods before the word vegan was even invented. It wasn't invented until 1944. But Charles and Myrtle Fillmore understood these things back in the early 1900s. They had, for example, a Bible that Unity published, I think, in around 1920. And they didn't have really any alternative to leather, but they didn't want any animals to suffer for their Bible, so they created one of the very first Bibles that was created with this sort of proto-Nagahide kind of material, and they came out with that Bible that was free of animal suffering. They had the Unity Vegetarian Inn, which at the time, at its peak, was serving more vegetarian meals than any restaurant in North America. In Kansas City, they were serving hundreds of meals every day for lunch. Unity was well known as being a vegetarian movement. They had the Unity Vegetarian Cookbook. Charles and Myrtle both were not, like as I said, not only vegetarians, but they didn't eat any dairy products or eggs, primarily out of concern for the welfare of these animals. And today, just a mere 60, 70 years later, it's been effectively covered up and forgotten, and of the tens of thousands of people attending Unity services, no one ever hears this message. And I myself have found that if I talk to ministers about it, virtually no minister is vegetarian in the Unity movement, or very, very, very few. They all say, oh, yeah, that vegetarianism, that was one of Charles and Myrtle's, that was one of their quirks. They say, they had a few quirks, and that was one of them, but it's not part of their essential teachings in any way. And it's just basically been ignored. And I think the same thing has happened in many other traditions as well, even in Buddhism, which, is clearly a vegetarian or actually a vegan movement from the beginning. Veganism being defined by the fellow who coined the word as refraining from causing suffering to animals, that a life that where we don't cause unnecessary suffering to animals. And that's been covered up. There's so many Buddhists that I know who feel that it's totally fine to eat animal foods, that you should never criticize anyone for what they're eating, just eat whatever you want.
I don't really criticize anybody for what they eat. I just tell them, don't ask me unless you want to, put your fork down right now and never finish your dinner.
Right.
Because if somebody asks me, I'll give them that education, but if they're sitting there enjoying whatever they're stuffing down their face, I'm not going to say anything, because what's the point in volunteering if they don't want to know? Now, didn't Buddha say that eating meat destroys the attitude of great compassion?
Right, and it's fundamental. I mean, I lived as a Zen monk in Korea in a monastery that had been vegan for 650 years, and it was very powerful to be there and just to be in this environment of kindness and compassion for all life that goes back for centuries upon centuries. And that's, I think, the essence. And it's been able to be carried out, I think, better in the Eastern traditions because they're less dominated by this herding mentality. But the Western, the culture we were born into, is so dominated by this mentality that animals are merely commodities that we buy and sell and cook and kill and use, that Buddhism, when it comes to the West, very often we find that people just start eating them.
Right. Well, what cracks me up is people that use I'm too busy or it's easy, it's convenient for me to eat this way.
That is really true, and that's so ironic. If people say that it's too inconvenient to change the way they're eating, and I think that's something we should really look at, you know, because number one, it's not difficult. I mean, it really is not. People make it out to be like you need some kind of esoteric degree in nutrition to be a vegan, and it's really not true. You basically eat a variety of plant-based foods. You'll get ample, high-quality protein. You'll be in basically much better physical shape than someone who's eating the standard American diet of going and eating foods in restaurants, and especially fast food joints, and buying the foods that are in supermarkets. Flesh of animals and especially dairy products are extremely toxic. These animals are raised in toxic environments, and they have naturally occurring substances like casein in milk and IGF-1 hormone in milk, and the huge cholesterol loads and saturated fat loads that are in these foods. So it's much harder, actually, to be healthy on a standard diet. So people, when they say it's inconvenient, I think number one, it's not difficult to be a vegan, and the other thing is, it just shows I guess it's built in. I don't mean to be critical, but it just really does show an extreme lack of caring for other living beings. I mean, if we saw an animal not too far away that was really suffering, someone was harming the animal unnecessarily, I think all of us would go out of our way to try to help the animal. We would do something. Life isn't just about being convenient. We all know we're here for a purpose, and that we're here, I think we know at a deep level that we're here to help the world.
Right.
We have a purpose for that, to be a blessing in the world. And so when people say it's inconvenient, I think like saying they could care less about these beings. And that attitude is very, very dangerous, because how would we feel if we were being harmed and people went by and said, it's just too inconvenient for me to stop and help here. And that was the attitude, basically, that allowed slavery to continue for so long in this country.
But it connects to a lack of compassion. And how can you have true compassion?
The lack of compassion is what it is. The compassion has been repressed by the culture. We've been forced to become numb and disconnect and say, it's only a chicken. Don't worry, And yet, that's right there, that mentality that reduces beings to mere things.
Well, I have a friend who's a chiropractor, and she works with a lot of homeopathics, and she works with kinesiology, et cetera. But we'd go out to dinner, and she'd always order meat. And I would look at her and say, but you're a chiropractor. You should know better. And she would come up with a million excuses until one night we went out, and she actually ordered a veggie burger. I almost had a heart attack. I said, what's this about? She goes, well, the Dalai Lama just said all Buddhists have to be vegetarian. And I said, you needed him to tell you that? So to me, that was the wrong reason. To do it for your health is the wrong reason, although I will tell you, my health has improved by leaps and bounds since I went vegetarian. But it had nothing to do with why I did it. I have some friends that like to call and torture me and tell me about vegetable recalls or how I'm going to suffer and, whatever, not be healthy being a vegetarian, and I always remind them that's not why I became a vegetarian. It had everything to do with caring for the animals, not myself.
You're really speaking of truth here. I mean, this is so important, what you're saying. And I remember Isaac Bashevis Singer, when someone said, so do you, you're a vegetarian? He said, yes. And he said, so you do it for health reasons? And he said, yes, for the health of the chickens.
That's a good one.
And it really is, because the health is better. I mean, there's no question about it. But most people eat meat. The one reason they do is that they can think of is, well, I think they need it for their health. There's no other excuse you can give. No one could say, well, I like to eat meat because I like to just think of animals, writhing on the floor in blood. They don't have that reason. The only reason they can think of is, well, I need it to be healthy. That's the one reason. So they think that must be the reason we're not doing it. And I think, really, we know it's much deeper reasons than that.
Well, I have to tell you, when I was reading the chapter, again, The Metaphysics of Food, and you were talking about testosterone and all the testosterone in our foods, women now getting injections of testosterone, blah, 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 blah. It was at a time when somebody asked me, why is George Bush so violent? And I had just read that one sentence that I just cracked up laughing, and I said, holy crap. And it's a quote by consciousness theorist Ken Wilber. I think you know where I'm going with this, Will.
Right.
It says, studies on testosterone in the laboratory, cross-culturally, embryonically, and even what happens when women are given testosterone injections for medical reasons, all point to a simple conclusion. I don't mean to be crude, but it appears that testosterone basically has two and only two major drives. Fuck it or kill it. And when I read that, it was like the floodgates of understanding just popped through my mind in ways that I didn't imagine before. And when you think about all this testosterone that is synthetic testosterone in our men who already can't get erections, thank God for the blue pill, I suppose, and you look at all the hormones in our daughters' foods and little girls who are menstruating at 8 years old, you know, having breasts at 10, sex at 11,
right.
How can they not make the connection between what we're pumping into our children and what's happening to their bodies? We're forcing them to grow faster the same way we force animals to.
Right. This is really important. Especially, you know, in dairy products, but also in meat, there are huge amounts of hormones. And the estrogen load in milk is the driving force behind girls. Instead of having their first period, it's called menarche, at around the age of 17 or 18, which is actually traditional up until just relatively recently in the West. And now you can see it, especially in Japan, where just in a matter of like two generations, it went from 17 or 18 to like 12. When they just introduced dairy products.
Mm-hmm.
And that causes untold anguish of teenage pregnancies and all these things, and no one makes that connection. But the other thing is that people that eat the typical standard American diet is low in fiber, and fiber is what actually allows the testosterone that's naturally flowing in the bodies of men to be reduced, and so when we're not eating a lot of fiber, the testosterone is much higher level, and I think that's one of the main reasons you see so much when meat eaters have so much inherent irritability and frustration and violence and so forth.
Right, maybe that's why we're such a sex-crazed culture, even though we talk about it, we look at it, we think about it, we parade it around in movies, but most people aren't having any. So you got to look at how strange is that. You know, I got a report years ago saying that they, you know, when they questioned a whole bunch of Americans, what's your favorite pastime? They said sex, but they said that the average American only spends 28 minutes, I think a month, on their favorite pastime.
Mm.
And maybe there's a connection between the twisted sexuality in this country and what we eat.
That's really true, and the frustration, I mean, there's like multiple levels to that question, boy. I mean, first of all, just the fact that men have such difficulty having an erection because all the arteries in the body get clogged up by saturated fat and cholesterol that's contained in cheese and eggs and the flesh of animals, so not just the heart arteries, but also down in the penis, so they just can't get an erection anymore, but plus all the oppression of women that starts so early, the hardening. You know, it's amazing, it's tragic, really, to read studies of young boys in this culture and how they're raised in a hurting culture to disconnect from their feelings. You know, when they're 4, 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, they have available to them a full range of emotions. By the time they're 14, 15 years old, they're basically reduced to one emotion, which is anger and fear. And there's just so much.
Right, and then you see why they can. Yeah. They look at women as if they're just another piece of meat.
Exactly. Like,
while women are exaggerating the same body parts that we're exaggerating on our animals to get more production out of them.
Yeah, the mammary glands. Exactly.
I mean, you know, to me, it's a very scary scenario. And again, your book puts this together in ways that even my imaginative mind could never have done such a good job. Now, here's another little loaded question for you, Will.
Okay.
Because I'm going to make you take the responsibility for this answer. Spiritual death. Everybody wants to think that they're here on a spiritual journey. And if they donate to a good cause and they, you know, they're good to their kids and they plant a tree once in a while, they see that as spiritual advancement. Do you honestly believe that our food choices contribute to spiritual death?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you know, it's first of all, we're all the spiritual teachings say that it's very important to leave home. Leaving home means questioning the assumptions of our culture. It's the only way we're actually going to have an authentic spiritual life, and the only way our culture is ever going to evolve, is if we question the underlying assumptions of the culture we're born into, especially this culture. So anyone who's eating animal foods, first of all, has not left home. They're still at home. They're still, you know, within the realm of being basically a programmed automaton on some level of just doing what they've been told to do and not questioning what they're doing. So you can't have a spiritual life and be a slave or just be an automaton or just be someone who's just acting out programming that and unquestioningly. What spirituality is about becoming an authentic human being with some sense of the interconnectedness of all life and a sense of being connected to some greater consciousness and awareness. And that is the most powerful kind of a person in our culture, someone who questions things and has a sense of being not just merely a conditioned object that will be born and will die, but that is of the nature of consciousness and awareness and compassion and freedom and creativity and love. Mm-hmm. And once we connect with that, that's what we really are, then we realize that we've endured programming in this culture that's forced us to disconnect from the truth that we are, and that if we keep acting that out, that's the antithesis of spirituality. Spirituality is liberating, and this is enslaving us. And so if we don't change our food habits, if we're eating the flesh and secretions of brutalized animals, that's a clear indication that we've never left home and that we're still basically within the confines of the mass consciousness of being basically
we're a violent people. We're destroying our own habitat.
Right.
Where most of our clean water in America is going to raise animals so that we can stay fat and sick. Oh God, I said the F word. And yet people don't make the connection. You know, all these wars, all this murder, and who doesn't cry when you see a picture of a starving child in another country where their stomach's blown out because they've been stuffing themselves with sand? Yet we can't just say we're going to send them 30 cents a day so they can stay alive and not realize that we have to change the world, because we're probably the only species that is going to go extinct because we're destroying our own nest of what we need to stay alive.
Right. Well, you know, that's exactly right. And I think it's this mentality of disconnectedness that's really at the core of the loss of real intelligence in our culture. And that's what we were forced into as children. We were forced to disconnect the reality that's on our plate mm-hmm. from the reality that it took to get it on our plate. And so
right.
since we learn and we practice over and over again disconnecting from reality in a ritual-like way 3 times a day, we learn to stay shallow and not look deeply, and then we're very easily manipulated. You know, people, we can do like what happened on 9/11, for example. People just are so easily fooled because we just disconnect. We just,
exactly.
We're so great at disconnecting. We practice it 3 times a day, and we can look without seeing. We can look and stay shallow and be manipulated. And so if we really want freedom and wisdom, and we need to have compassion and reconnect the reality that's on our plate and where it came from.
All right. I think you had a quote in your book. I can't find it right now. I think it might have been Gandhi, who said that the most violent weapon we have on earth is our fork.
Right, right. Yeah, he did say that.
You know, and you know, John McDougall, who I loved, you know, I've had John on the show a few times. You have a really good quote in your book by him that says, "The pain and suffering inflicted on children by the American diet is so brutal that if it were administered with a stick, parents would be put in jail." And you look at how many kids now, they're saying the number one drugs our kids are taking now are cholesterol drugs and anti-heartburn pills. And you got to make the connection. You know, when I was a kid, maybe it's easier for me to be a vegetarian than others. And believe me, Will, every now and then I send my listeners recipes so they can see how easy it is.
Right.
We were poor. We were poor Italians. And we never had meat in the house. And then one day, I don't know, maybe I was 11 years old, when my mother introduced meat once a week as a symbol of your father works hard, this means we're doing well, you have to eat it. And I remember saying to my mother, why do we have to eat this? I'm happy eating what we eat every night. And it was literally forced on us because they saw it as a symbol of, you know, one-upmanship. You know, they're coming up into the world.
Elitism, yeah. That's universal, unfortunately. It's too bad. It should be the other way around, actually.
So for me, I just go back to my old comfort foods and the recipes that I liked before I was forced. And I mean, my mother took it as a total offense. If I wouldn't eat turkey or wouldn't eat chicken or would definitely not eat the meat she'd put on a plate.
Isn't that ironic? I mean, those are the most unhealthy foods, and yet she was the most offended that you wouldn't eat them.
Right, but at least all those years ago, it wasn't as filthy and disgusting as it is today. And that's what I try to tell people when they give me that excuse, my grandparents ate meat and pork and blah, 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 and they lived to be 95. And I'm like, yeah, but you can't compare factory farm foods to what we were eating 50 or 60 or 80 years ago.
That's true. That's true. But the fundamental fact, anyway, is there are certain people, you know, that will live whatever. I mean, they do the LD50 tests on dogs. They, like, give them on animals, give them a toxic substance. And there always are some animals that die sooner and some die later from toxic substances. But that doesn't mean they're not toxic anyway. You know?
Right. Right. Well, Will, I have to tell you, this has been a pleasure interviewing you today. And, you know, for my listeners, do what you want with the information. My life doesn't go on one day longer or shorter, whether you change your life or you don't. But for my students out there, especially my Reiki students, they all now know, Will, that your book is part of their curriculum.
Great.
And, you know, if you really want to say you're a true spiritual person, you have to stop participating in the slaughter of our fellow earthlings. So, Will, please keep me posted, and if ever there's anything I can do for you, just let me know.
I sure will. It's been great talking with you, Maria.
Same here. Take good care.
Okay.
Bye.
Yeah, bye.
Will Tuttle, The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. So everybody that wants to tell me, you know, how unhealthy my body's going to be, B12, this, that, I have no attachment to my body. I'm glad it works. I'm glad it's healthy. Was never the reason that I went vegan. Anyway, whew, that was that for today. But you know what? Maybe I should ask him if I could have permission to read his entire book on the air in different chapters day by day, because I'm so thrilled with it. Anyway, thanks for listening. Thanks for being patient. You know, don't feel guilty. Don't feel bad. Forgive yourself. Make the changes in your life you can. Even as not Dr. Neil Bernard said, there's so many great shows in the archives. Please avail yourself of them. Even cutting back 10% of the animal products you eat would be a great thing for the planet and a great thing for your health. And we are all in this together.
In a world of fear, hatred, and insanity, there is one place to find peace and information without any hidden agenda. The Maria Show. Maria comes from a place of love for all living things, a wry New York wit, and a keen eagle eye on the bad guys, thanks to a great intuition and clarity of mind. Maria does the homework so you don't have to. Maria recognizes the dangers of our times and puts out constant information on how to fight the reptilian agenda of control over the whole planet. From your diet to the government conspiracies, Maria will awaken your mind and free your soul. Subscribe today. If you can afford to subscribe over the requested amount, your soul will be rewarded for helping this brave woman continue on in her fight for real truth, real justice, and the real American way. www.maria.net. That's www.meria.net. We are the ones you've been waiting for, and we didn't come here to lose.